All right, foamers, get out your high-vis Red Star conductor hats, because today we are going to do one of our favorite things on the Antifada, left sectarian train watching. We're joined by Aidan Beattie, a lecturer in the history department of Carnegie Mellon University, a contributor to Jacobin, Washington Post, and the Irish Times, and the author of the new book, The Party is Always Right, The Untold Story of Jerry Healey and British Trotskyism. Thanks for joining us, Aidan. How's it going?
I'm pretty good. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you.
Cool.
So obviously this is a topic I'm very enthusiastic about, having written my own book about a weird and abusive Trotskyist sect. So it was I feel like we've written sibling books here, which is really nice.
I think so, yeah.
We're building a whole cursed genre of.
Some might say you're slowly brick by brick building a party.
Mm-hmm. I hope not, but okay.
Or at least a section of a leftist bookstore.
Sure.
But yeah, so we're going to be talking about Jerry Healey and the Workers' Revolutionary Party of Britain, and some hopefully funny and enlightening stories about the history of British Trotskyism and Trotskyism in general. But let's start by getting to know you a little bit, Aidan. I'm always curious reading these books, what the political background is of the author, and then also how you came to write about this subject.
Sure. Politically, I don't know if there's a huge amount to report on. I'm sort of nominally left-wing, but not the most politically active of people. A couple of years ago, I had been writing a couple of different things about Marx and Engels and their writings on Ireland. And I'm from Ireland originally and have been living in the US off and on since about 2009. And I had written a paper on Mary Burns and Lizzie Burns, who are two, essentially they're Engels's wives, but they're also two sisters. He was in a relationship with one. They were common law wives, but never formally married. And then when Mary Burns died, he essentially started a relationship with Lizzie Burns.
Yeah. Great scene in the Young Marx movie about.
And I actually started by talking about that movie and what it gets wrong. And part of what it gets wrong is that we actually just don't know a huge amount about those women. And that was what I was kind of interested in about that. I was interested in, like, here are two women that are around two of the most literate men of the 19th century, and yet we know very little about them. So aside from just the kind of politics of all this and just being interested in Irish history, I was also just interested in the kind of basic methodological problem of how much can you know about these two people? So I finished that in 2019, and I wanted to do something like that again. And Jerry Healey was this guy that I knew about, partly because I'm from about 25 miles where he grew up in the west of Ireland. Partly also just because I'm interested in the history of Irish socialism, and I'm interested in just kind of weird stories. And I thought this would be like a fun thing to start just investigating. Fun and weird and in some ways disturbing. There are some things about him that are not funny, that are just really like quite off-putting and quite disturbing. So early 2020, I started gathering up material about him. As you probably know from writing a book about Trotskyism, it's pretty easy to find Trotskyist stuff. They tend to just dump a lot of their material on the internet, or if you're a bit more sympathetic, like they have very well-curated archives on the internet. And then as the pandemic started, I just started doing this more and more, and it became a thing I would just do to distract myself, just acquiring more and more material about Jerry Healey, not really knowing where it would go. And at first I thought maybe this will be like another like obscure academic journal article. Maybe it'll be some piece of journalism that I try to shop around somewhere. And at a certain point I realized I had about a 90 page thing written up about him that just kept growing and growing. And then as the pandemic eased, I started doing interviews with former members. And then eventually ended up going to Britain for like an extended period to do archival research on them. And basically it just sort of, without me really intending it to do this, it just grew into a book about this fairly odd person and his fairly sect-like group that he was involved with.
Cool. So yeah, let's give listeners a brief outline of Healey and the WRP before we get more into the scandalous details.
So I'll maybe start in towards the end of his career, he founded this group called the Workers' Revolutionary Party in 1973. He was the leader of it until 1985. They were very, very ultra-leftist, very much believed that a revolution was just around the corner in Britain. It was always just around the corner, and it always keeps disappearing, and they keep striving for it all through the 70s and 80s.
Like self-driving cars.
this is their version of a mythology of a better future to come.
Mm-hmm.
When he founds his group in 73, he's already been involved in left-wing politics and far-left politics for really all of his adult life, probably going back to the late 1920s, but certainly by the late 1930s, when we have the first like really good, clear evidence of him being involved in left-wing politics. He had been in the Communist Party, and then for some reason, he leaves the Communist Party and becomes a Trotskyist. And even within Trotskyism, he has a pretty bad reputation. Very, very sectarian, very argumentative. And then certainly by the 50s and 60s, he has a reputation for fairly extreme levels of physical violence. So if you're a member of one of his groups and you put your head above the parapet and criticize him in any way, there's a good chance you'll just get beaten up, quite badly assaulted. There's quite a few number of well-documented cases of that happening. And then he founds this group in 73 that kind of continues that reputation in a way, ultra-doctrinaire, very sectarian, continue to be quite violent. They kind of add in a few other things that they become notorious for. They're very, very pro-Libyan, very pro-Iraqi. There starts to be like very odd accusations about, do they have connections to the Iraqi government, the Libyan government? Are they getting funded by them?
Yeah, and at this point, that's the government of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. So it's pretty much as Saddam is taking over in the late 70s, early 80s, that they become very pro-Ba'athist, very, very adulatory in the thing that they write and say about Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, I mean, he strikes me as one of the farther right figures in Trotskyism, or one of the figures that approaches basically Stalinism.
Yeah, I mean, they have a brief moment where they actually are attracting a lot of communists who are leaving the British Communist Party after 56, right? After the famous speech that Khrushchev gives, where he basically admits to Stalin's crimes, and after the Soviet invasion of Hungary, about 200 people joined his party at the time, almost all of whom leave again. A few do stay, but most of them, like, they're looking for something different to Stalinism, and they definitely don't find it with him. Now, all Trotskyists have a tendency of accusing each other of being kind of cause of Stalinists, but with him, definitely the organizational structure that he favors is very rigid, very authoritarian, and very dictatorial.
For maybe the U.S. audience, maybe the biggest cultural touchstone connecting what we might know to the WRP is the actress Vanessa Redgrave, who I really like a lot of her movies, especially The Devils. I haven't seen her movie The Palestinians, but I think that's been shown a lot recently. And I knew that she was a Trot, but I didn't fully realize how deeply enmeshed she was with the Workers' Revolutionary Party and that she was actually part of the central group there, and a lot of her work was selling newspapers, and she was doing this while she was a well-known actress. So how did she end up in the WRP?
Well, she comes from this like very, very well-connected family, famous theatrical family. Her father was a theater director. Her brother is an actor or was an actor. So she's, at the end of the 60s, she's already fairly well involved in a lot of left-wing causes. You'll find her showing up at, let's say, rallies in defense of Irish republicanism, anti-Vietnam War protests, organizing fundraising for Black Power movements, like to basically send money from Britain to the US. Her brother, Corin Redgrave, gets involved first. And essentially, Corin Redgrave and Healy kind of badger her into joining until eventually she gives in. There's some evidence that she was on a kind of a low moment in her life, and this is when she finally gives in. You get a lot of I think like pretty underhanded and pretty nasty commentary about her, about why she was joining. That, is she looking for another, strong father figure to replace her father? Is this just kind of another role for her, and it's all just kind of cosplaying or acting? And none of that is ever said about Corin Redgrave. It's only ever about her, which I think is kind of shows how just nasty and sexist this is.
Yeah.
I think she is was, and obviously she's still alive and still is a fairly committed person. Like, she has quite strong beliefs and quite strong left-wing beliefs. So this is a genuine commitment for her to what she sees as the most radical socialist movement in the UK. I think both her and Corin Redgrave do have a desire for some kind of like hard politics, or like a more tough politics that's not the kind of soft, what they see as like the soft, flimsy politics of the hippies. They want something more militant. And in some ways, I think Healey really plays up that to them. He really flatters them. He knows how to kind of stoke their ego a little bit. It's not just that they are sort of that they ascend to leadership positions in this party. They are really fast tracked into leadership positions. And I think that does a lot to like pull them into the party quite a bit and make them very committed members.
Very opportunistic move on Healey's part.
And that gets commented on a lot by his detractors, right? There's a kind of a joke in Britain at the time. The WRP actually stood for West End Revolutionary Party, because the West End is where all the theaters are in London. They become very known as a party for attracting actors. One of their big like bases in the labor movement is in Equity, in the Actors Union, which is, I mean, that's a real union for real people. But I think there's also the fact that some of these people that Healey is recruiting are fairly wealthy, willing to give fairly large amounts of money to the party. That's definitely part of this opportunistic side of it too.
And he seemed to be well known in those circles in the 60s. There was a play about him that Laurence Olivier portrayed him in. Is that right?
Yeah, so this is a play in the early 70s called The Party, written by Michael Trevor Griffiths, who's, you know, a style of playwright that probably doesn't really exist anymore in the UK, like a very politically conscious social realist writer who writes this play that is sort of sympathetic to Healey and kind of not, right? I mean, there are people in the play who say that the character that's based on Healey is just a brutal thug, and there's other people in the play that are clearly impressed by him, by his character, and that itself, that play is quite directly based on a real set of experiences that Healey had, and that a lot of these actors are also having, where people in the late 60s in the theater world in London start having these like kind of invite only parties where they'll invite people like Healey or left-wing intellectuals, left-wing political activists, to essentially have debates. There are people who attend those parties who say Healey completely dominated all these, you know, hoity-toity, like, academic intellectuals because he was a real tough intellectual who could, like, destroy them. There's other people, like Sheila Rowbottom, very famous feminist historian, who said she was at those meetings and just found Healey to be completely incapable of understanding anything about feminism or Freudianism. You get very contradictory memories of what those events were actually like. Mm.
So a polarizing figure, even among people that you might have interviewed or heard accounts from.
Yeah, and I think that kind of like polarizingness is something I found really interesting about him, that you can find these like specific moments in his life and you ask people, like, how do you remember that? And you will get like completely divergent versions of the truth, which is just kind of an interesting challenge to then, like, how do you tell like a coherent story where the people themselves are not very coherent, you know, or not very in agreement about what actually happened.
And what do you make of a real historical actor who's such a seeming chameleon, right? Somebody that's not just potentially opportunistic, but also somebody that seems like a little slippery, right?
Yeah. I mean, I always resist kind of, I try to always resist, you know, writing too much about his personal psychology or anything like that. But there are definitely moments when that I could really feel myself being pulled towards that. I really wanted to try and understand him as a psychological character, even though that wasn't really the kind of book I wanted to write, but it's a very tempting like question to get into.
Well, I think one way his character comes out is when you're talking about his manner of speaking. He's a Trotskyist who's really interested in dialectics and philosophy. So this is a piece that Healey wrote in 1988. Dialectical logic as a science is developed in the process of cognizing phenomena negated from the infinite motion of the external world. The phenomena which demand our most urgent attention are generated by the world-class struggle and its continuous interaction with the property relations established by the October 1917 Socialist Revolution. This process constitutes the form and content of the political revolution now well underway in the USSR. This is 1988. It is achieved through the use of images, which are sensations whose source is in the world of the class struggle. They are then analyzed in themselves through the use of the dialectical thought logic. As Lenin explains, images and thought, the development of both, nothing else. So he's got a really kind of dense philosophical Hegelian justification for the way his party thinks and acts. And some people are really drawn into that. And some people think he's just talking nonsense. What do you think? Do you think there was something to his use of philosophy?
In the most literal sense, is this good philosophy, or is there some, you know, substantive content to it as philosophy? No, I don't think so. And there are quite a lot of people, including, you know, former members, who will come out and say, like, this is rubbish, this is gobbledygook, this is gibberish that he's just spouting. I think there's a few different things I would say about all this, though. One is there are people who I interviewed who I thought, like, this person is clearly smart and is clearly capable. And they would say, like, when I heard him give these speeches, I was just captivated and it pulled me in. And then later I would try to think, like, what was he talking about? And I couldn't remember any of it. And I think part of the problem is actually this isn't really supposed to be printed. And when it gets printed, it loses something. One of his former followers who has a very dramatic break with him, a man called Tim Woolforth, who is an American follower of his, years later says, like, Healy was one of the most radical, the world's foremost radical showman, I think is the exact phrase. And I think there's something that he was capable of doing that was incredibly performative with this, like, in reality, nonsense philosophy. So that if you experienced it in these, like, 3 or 4 hour lectures that he would give, it would be really captivating. But then when you actually read what he was saying, it's nonsense. But I also think on some level he knew this was nonsense. His goal was not actually to produce, you know, serious intellectual philosophy. I think what he was really doing with a lot of that stuff is creating a kind of a shared vocabulary for the party. So there's a lot of these words he uses again and again, like idealism and subjectivism, or being subjective, or being pragmatic, or practicing pragmatism. And those are all bad things for him. So anyone that criticizes him, he will just label them idealist or subjective or pragmatic or a pragmatist. And I think it's actually quite valuable for him that those words have no actual content for him. They have no, like, substantive meaning. They're just slurs to use to, like, denounce anyone that opposes him. And then, you know, anything that's good, anything he does is objective or dialectic, or he's practicing dialectical materialism, which again has no formal substantive meaning. It's a term of praise that he can use. And this is one of the places where they start to actually become a very cult-like group. They're developing an insular language that makes no sense to outsiders, which kind of cuts them off from the outside world in some ways. It means that their ideas can't be actually communicated externally. Like, they become very closed in and insular as a result of that. And I think that is very intentional on his part.
Really reminds me of somebody like Lyndon LaRouche,
who he did actually have some contacts with when LaRouche used to be a Trotskyist. There's brief moments where he starts trying to recruit LaRouche. I think LaRouche was in the Spartacists, and was trying to work with him. And then obviously I think that didn't work out.
They would have made a great tag team. It's a shame.
Yeah.
Maybe moving away from, like, the culture of the group, what were some of the major impacts they had in British or world politics? It was always a small group, but Trotskyists are always small groups, but sometimes they can have a pretty big impact.
Yeah, I mean, they run for election. They don't do particularly well. Now, they would claim, well, we didn't want to do well. We're there to, like, promote socialist ideas, or proper Trotskyist ideas that we want to bring to the masses. There is a Trotskyist who runs for election in Britain in right after World War II, and then until the early 70s, no Trotskyist runs for election. So it's actually, it's the WRP, as well as a couple of other groups, who all simultaneously start running for elections in 1974. So if this is an impact, I don't know, but like they're one of the groups who restart the idea of let's run for elections to promote socialist ideas to the masses. Rarely ever do they break 1%. Do any of these parties break 1% in the British electoral system? When they're founded in 1973, they have a member called Alan Thornett, who is basically a labor activist in a factory in Oxford called British Leyland, which is a notoriously strike-prone, very militant factory. And that's them. Like they're, you know, the Workers' Revolutionary Party are at the heart of that militancy. Unfortunately for the WRP, Thornett starts to criticize the leadership by quite quickly in the foundation of the party, right? By 74, he's criticizing the leadership for being so strictly, for adhering so strictly to this idea that a revolution is really imminent. And Thornett is actually systematic, him and his followers are systematically pushed out. So that's, you know, in a way, that's one of the few moments when the WRP actually has this like formal impact on British life, right? On kind of politics in the broad sense of like social activism and like on British society. And they kind of cut that off by being so sectarian. They do retain a certain like connection to other trade unions, like labor unions in Britain. They're involved. They have a few members who are involved in the National Union of Mine Workers. So when there's a huge strike in 1984-85, they give their support to that. They sell their newspaper on like picket lines and things like that. Supposedly, Arthur Scargill, the leader of the National Union of Mine Workers, had said the only newspaper he would allow to be sold was Newsline, the WRP newspaper, to be sold on picket lines. But by that period, they're also not really interested in rank-and-file activism. And I think, like a lot of the most doctrinaire Trotskyist groups, they're actually kind of fearful of spontaneous working-class organizing. They want everything to be controlled from the top down. So they actually are much more interested in working directly with Scargill and with the union leadership, which probably alienates quite a lot of their members who want to see them take a role in what is actually looks, you know, what looks a lot like a revolutionary moment in British life. We have this huge strike that pits a union against the government. And a lot of the disillusionment about that starts to become part of a broader disillusionment within the party that's going to lead eventually to their collapse in 1985, or their fracturing, I should say, more than collapse.
Yeah, and that moment and 1968 are two moments that seem to be mass political events that the Trotskyists, mm-hmm. like on paper at least, seem like they could have some role in, like a 68, for example. It seems like the Trotskyists, you know, since the end of World War II, are waiting for this like international grassroots upsurge that needs leadership, needs like real Bolshevik leadership that the Soviet Union and China are not going to give because they're kind of deformed by Stalinism. And I think in both cases, although I know a lot less about the miners' strike, most Trotskyist groups look at 68 and just denounce it initially, and then as it gains more and more momentum, they see it as a recruitment opportunity, and they're able to fill their ranks to some extent, but they have no actual political impact on its trajectory. And that seems to be the case with Healey as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's things going on in the late 60s that actually cause Healey's group at the time, the Socialist Labor League, to be kind of eclipsed in some ways by newer Trotskyist groups who are more willing to work with students, more willing to get involved in anti-Vietnam War protests. The Socialist Labor League, Healey's group at the time, on one occasion actually went out handing out leaflets at an anti-Vietnam War protest, telling people not to join because the Viet Cong are Stalinist and you should not have anything to do with them. But certainly by like 69, 70, they're really being swept up by this feeling that like a revolution might be here. And that's really what Healey, I think, is trying to capitalize on in 73 when he founds this group called the Workers' Revolutionary Party. If you look at all of British Trotskyism after 68, they all tend to like expand their numbers and rise up in membership. So that maybe by like 73, 74, 75, there's probably about 20,000 active Trotskyists in Britain. There's more Trotskyists than there are Stalinists. Like more people involved in groups like the WRP or the International Marxist Group or the International Socialists. But they're all divided among these different groups rather than in one single Communist Party of Great Britain. There is a sense in 85 that like maybe the revolution is here, but to be honest, Trotskyism is already kind of collapsing, I think, in Britain by that point. Across the first half of the 80s, what used to be called the militant tendency, which was basically a Trotskyist faction within the Labour Party, is just being systematically purged and kicked out from the party. The International Marxist Group, which people like Tariq Ali were involved with, they kind of fracture and collapse after 1983. And then this collapse of the WRP in 1985 is part of the same problem that Trotskyism has, that I think like all of the radical left and just the broader left in general in Britain are having a problem in the early 80s in that they don't really know how to respond to Thatcherism. They're not really willing to accept that actually Thatcherism is a successful political project and it is eclipsing you and it is undermining you as a movement.
And so what about these connections to Gaddafi and Hussein and also the PLO? How did these come about and what was Healey trying to do?
Well, I think even going back to the 50s, he had like his different groups have a genuine commitment to some kind of anti-imperialism, which is there's a particular resonance to doing that in Britain at the moment in the 50s when Britain is itself decolonizing. So they are talking a lot to people from places like Guyana, to people from Egypt. They're very interested in Algeria, and I think this in some ways is just a continuation of that. They're very interested in those kind of militant groups. There are definite connections that they have with the PLO. There are also just some really bizarre conspiracy theories that start to circulate about them that more right-wing people in Britain engage in, that the PLO is paying them to come to pro-Palestinian protests and things like that. They are, I would say, and this is one of the things that I think is quite genuinely good about them as an organization. They're one of the first groups in Britain to really push for Palestinian solidarity at a time when other Trotskyist groups would have still have had some, would be still holding on to some illusion that like Israel might be a socialist society or we might be able to make connections with Israelis. They have no interest whatsoever. The WRP has no interest in Israel. It's very, very pro-Palestinian. Healey himself then makes claims about that he, you know, taught classes on Marxist on Marxist philosophy to members of the PLO. I think that probably did happen, but I think it was like very grassroots members. It happened once, and then I think the PLO kind of kept them at a distance a little bit. So they're really pulling, you know, they're trying to grasp and make these connections with the PLO at a time when the PLO coming into the early 70s is much more interested in building high level connections with international governments, is not really interested in a small Trotskyist group. Probably having Vanessa Redgrave helps a little bit, right? They have this, you know, after 1978, an Oscar winning actress in their ranks. They have a daily newspaper, which they can use to promote pro-Palestinian ideas. So like, that stuff does attract the PLO, I think, even if the PLO also kind of recognize these people are a little bit to be kept a little bit at a distance. The Libyan stuff is, you know, in a way, in the 70s, that's the most notorious thing about the WRP is that they are they're accused of being a mouthpiece for the Libyan government. In 1977, they issued the WRP and the Libyan government issued a joint declaration confirming their shared dedication to fighting against imperialism and Zionism. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of coverage that the WRP puts out in their newspapers that is very, very pro-Gaddafi. I mean, really uncritically pro-Gaddafi. There are accusations that they're getting money from the Gaddafi government. And they probably were. But some of these are, some of the money they're getting is actually just money they're getting for printing newspapers for the Libyan government. It's not sort of secret millions being shipped off to Jerry Healey. And then there are these kind of similar accusations about the Iraqi government. And I would be much more confident there in saying, I think the Saddam government know these are not a group to waste your money on. I've talked to some Iraqi historians who were very surprised to hear these accusations and just said, there's no way Saddam Hussein would have done that. He would have known not to waste your money on a group like this. I also think, on the one hand, Healey himself boosts these claims, right? He wants it to be known that the WRP is a group with really extensive international connections. So he wants these stories to circulate. And then other Trotskyist groups circulate these stories to say, Jerry Healey is just a grifter. He will say anything for money. He's just kowtowing to Gaddafi, to these, you know, bourgeois nationalist regimes in the Middle East. And the truth, I think, is a lot less exciting and sexy. A lot of the money that the party is getting is not coming from like ill-gotten Arab gold. They're just sweating money out of party members. That's where they fund themselves mainly, rather than anything exciting like international espionage or anything like that.
Or they have a press, so they were printing papers for Gaddafi. Was this like a pro-Libyan newspaper for a British audience?
So they have their own daily newspaper, okay. Which is a quite bizarre thing to have for such a small group. Wow. And in a way, is I think one of the things that destroys them, because they just become an organization that exists to sell this paper. Hmm. It's the first ever full-color daily newspaper in Britain.
Wow. That's Newsline?
That's Newsline, yeah.
That could be found at like regular newsstands?
No, this is the kind of thing that Vanessa Redgrave and other party members are doing. It's sold on the street. It has no advertising. So it's a newspaper that has to sell a lot of copies to actually even break even. They were probably selling about maybe 7,000 or 8,000 copies a day.
Wow.
Which at first I thought, okay, that's not great. I mean, you know, a good British tabloid will be selling in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, but hand to hand. I realized,
you know, for a small group, this is really impressive.
Yeah, but also selling it hand to hand is really impressive.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of hustle.
Like in Argentina, for example, there's Trotskyists have their newspapers at newsstands, but selling it hand to hand is much harder.
Yeah, so it's very DIY, very like you're not relying on anyone else. You are keeping all the revenue, I guess. So it's a better way to break even as a newspaper. But what this requires of party members is really unsustainable, I think, in the long run. If you're a party member and you also have a full-time job, you'll be expected to get up at 4 a.m, drive across the country, pick up newspapers being delivered from the north or wherever they're coming from, bring them back to your home city, sell them on the street, go to work for a full day, and then maybe go sell them in the evening again if you haven't made your quotas, right? So there are very like identifiable systems in place that I've seen in the course of my research, where the party head offices are sending out quotas to every branch of how many copies do you have to sell per day, per week. You are billed for those copies. So if you don't sell them or not, you're still paying for them.
Wow.
So a lot of party members go into debt, or you try to find a wealthy person who will just buy like 10 copies in a day and hope that you break even.
And there was one story in the book where a member just was too exhausted to sell his paper or just didn't want to. And he claimed that he had been arrested by the secret police or something.
Yeah, so this was a very interesting guy in Nottingham. He was like 16 years old. He was basically their one member themed in the city. So this is a city in the middle of England, would be like in the middle of a pretty heavy like mining district. He had dropped out of school and would just go selling this newspaper every day on the street. And then one day, like a lot of 16-year-olds, you know, he wanted to just go do something else for the day. He was kind of sick of this. So he just didn't bother to show up that day, and then told party leadership, like, yeah, I just got arrested by the British police. Then Healey shows up and they file a police report and say, like, we want to know why he was arrested. This kid's dad says, like, he wasn't arrested. He was here all day. So he gets kicked out of the party as a result. And this would be like in the immediate like run up to the miners' strike. So him and a friend of his then took these like collecting tins for collecting money for the party, and they were just going around mining districts outside of Nottingham, collecting money for the party, which then they would just keep. You know, sounds like they're 16 or 17.
Could be a Ken Loach movie.
Yeah, and then the kind of end of the story is he said something like, you know, then some WRP members came and just bet the shit out of him, and he never did it again.
They got their own enforcers.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's get to the downfall of Healy. Of course, all of this stuff is going on. You know, there's this sort of normal abuse of membership, like this escalating cycle of commitment where if you sell a lot of papers, you get rewarded by selling more papers, or if you don't sell enough, you get punished by selling more papers. So that's bad enough. And then, yeah, his kind of the cultishness in general is bad enough, but he was also sexually abusing a lot of his membership and grooming young women. So this all breaks in the 80s. Let's hear about how that all goes down.
So there's a couple of different female members, Aileen Jennings and Claire Cowan. Aileen Jennings was Healy's personal secretary. Cowan was a very long-time committed full-time worker for the party, came from a fairly wealthy background, and had actually given a lot of her like trust fund to the party. And in the early 80s, the party is actually really having a lot of financial problems. Like the newspaper is constantly losing money. They had bought a network of youth training centers. They'd bought a network of bookshops. The youth training centers never get off the ground. The bookshops are probably making some money and keeping the party afloat. And Jennings and Cowan are both very like committed members, and they believe in what they're doing. So they're aware of this financial problem, as well as wanting to solve it so that the party can actually survive. And then through kind of personal contact that they're having with each other, they both started to realize that they had some kind of sexual relationship with Healy that had been ongoing for several years. And I you know, it's hard to know what word to use to describe the kind of relationship that they had. Cowan would later write a memoir where she says this wasn't rape, because she did agree to have sex with Healy, but she agreed to have sex with him within an organization where you can't really say no to him. And Jennings essentially has the same situation. So they start talking to a couple of other members, and eventually five members altogether kind of form a kind of a secret group within the organization who are going to work to both push Healy out and solve the financial problem that the party has. So this group starts very tentatively and carefully talking to other female members to find out, have there been other women that Healy has targeted? And then in the summer of 1985, Aileen Jennings releases a letter that is read out to the political committee of the WRP, which is essentially the most central, most controlling body within the party, that in very kind of Trotskyist coded language says Healy has been carrying on sexual relations with other women, with multiple different women in the party, that he's using the apartment that the party owns that Healy lives in for these sexual liaisons. And there's 26 different women named in the letter. Every single version of the letter that I've ever seen, those names are redacted. And initially the party leadership just say, this is a provocation, we're not going to deal with this. Jennings disappears and nobody seems to know where she goes after this, which kind of adds to a lot of feeling of like intrigue and worry about like, has something been done to her? Has she been hurt? In fact, she had just gone into hiding, kind of absconded from the party. And then the letter starts to circulate among party membership. And there's a lot of people I talked to, like pretty much everyone I talked to, I wanted to ask them, like, what was your memory of this particular moment? Like when you first heard these revelations about Healy. And some people said, like, I was totally shocked. I never would have thought that he was doing this. And then would turn around and say, but, you know, I had heard rumors of this years earlier, which I found to be quite a telling thing about the kind of mentality of party members that they could actually compartmentalize this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Other people said, I didn't know any of this, but when I heard it, it just totally made sense that he would act like that. Or people said, like, I kind of had this information in my head and now everything just fell into place. So initially, Healy retires from the party. And then things basically kind of escalate. The actual party leadership, I think, start to realize the extent of what had been happening. And then they actually push to say, like, it's not just that he will retire, he will be expelled from the party. There is an incredibly contentious and even quite violent meeting of huge numbers of the party membership in October 1985 at their headquarters in London, where the two opposing sides start facing off against each other. And it is voted then to expel Healy from the organization. One of the things that I found kind of curious about this is one of the leading members of the party, a man called Mike Banda, he gives this multi-hour speech where he just goes through, like, in really, like, shocking detail, the amount of sexual abuse that Healy was carrying out. It seems to me that what he was tacitly doing was admitting he knew about this all along. Mm-hmm. When I interviewed Claire Cowan about this, she is very resistant to the idea that people knew. She said they might have known about particular cases here and there of women that Healy had abused. And this abuse had been going on, this sexual abuse had been going on at least since 1964, if not even earlier. But she is quite adamant that nobody knew the systematic nature of what Healy was doing. And that really only came out in 85. And in the aftermath of that, then the entire party just fractures. They have a huge portfolio of assets. They have this, you know, party headquarters. They own apartments in London. They own a very high-tech printing works. They own a mansion in Derbyshire that they use for party retreats. They own a network of bookshops. They own a network of youth training centers. All of that gets squabbled over and just kind of grabbed by different factions. So a lot of the party assets become part of this, like, fracturing of the organization.
And there was some tabloid coverage too. Had he been, like, a known figure in the tabloid press for a while, or did it really pick up around then?
I think, you know, because of Redgrave, the WRP are a fairly well-known entity. They would be known to people who follow politics in some way, because they always run in elections from 74 onwards. They have a presence, like, at street protests and things like that. So what you start to see first is, like, the more serious British newspapers just start running these very slim little stories saying, you know, the longtime leader of the far left group has been expelled. No explanation as to why he's expelled. And then the actual tabloid press pick up on this and they find out why this is happening. And really just the floodgates open to a lot of, like, very nasty coverage, completely downplaying the fact that these were cases of sexual assault and just talking about it as a kind of a funny, slightly pornographic story about, like, this old man who had access to lots of young women through this organization. I mean, really just playing it for kind of sexual titillation rather than really tackling the abusive nature of it all.
What happens to Healy after that?
So he dies 4 years later.
That might have been a blessing for him.
Yeah, he's quite old by this point anyway. He had some heart problems in the early 80s, which I think is part of what starts to foment people to move against him a little bit. He's seen as a bit weakened. He forms another group called the Marxist Party that has really just a handful of members. It's him and Vanessa Redgrave and Corin Redgrave and a few of their followers. It's a very, very small party. He has a heart attack in late 1989 and dies shortly afterwards. He is then cremated, buried right next to Marx in Highgate Cemetery in London.
Andy, I missed that when we went to visit Marx's grave. Andy, you should have told me.
I think I noticed it, but I didn't really, okay. I didn't totally know who he was, but I think I was like, oh, Jerry Healy.
Gotta point these things out to me, man.
Yeah. And then just as a kind of a suitable end, there are protests at his funeral by another Trotskyist group who picket his funeral to let it be known that they are opposed to him even in death.
Wow. Sectarian beyond the grave.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, like, some like a broad question for you, having gotten deep into this research. You know, you do begin in the first chapter in the introduction talking about Trotskyism more generally, and you point out that Trotsky had been somewhat of an independent figure previous to the revolution, and also had in fact critiqued the organizational practices of the Social Democratic Party of Russia, democratic centralism and secretism. So do you think that Healey's downfall is in any way connected to like a broader problem, structural problem within Trotskyism, the legacy of Trotsky himself? What do you think this sectarianism comes from? And should we blame Trotsky, Leon Trotsky himself, for the rise of a man like Jerry Healey?
I wouldn't directly blame Leon Trotsky, no.
Yeah, I think that'd be unfair, but I wanted to throw a provocation.
Yeah, sure. You know, as I was doing this book, I didn't really have any kind of serious motivation as to why I wanted to do it, and at least initially. I just thought this is an interesting story. I'd like to do more about it. And then as it just kind of grew and grew, I realized, well, I can't just write a book for the sake of writing a book. There has to be some bigger motivation. And really what I kind of focused in on was what's, I think, at the heart of your question, which is, this is a story about Leninism, and it's a story about this specific kind of party form that all Leninist parties, whether Stalinist or Trotskyist or Maoist, favor in some way or another. In theory, a very democratic party, but also a very centralized party. And I think, as a lot of people have pointed out, the problem with democratic centralist parties is they start to become more centralized than democratic over time. And I think if you're in a party where you can't criticize the leadership, and where the leadership will all, you know, the leading members will always close ranks against any kind of criticism, even the most valid of criticisms, that is a party that is going to be prone to abuse. It doesn't mean it'll like deterministically happen that an abuser will just eventually emerge automatically. But you are making it quite likely. And there's multiple different kinds of abuse that go on in these kinds of parties. There was like verbal and physical abuse all the time, and very openly so in the WRP. Multiple different people that I talked to, or multiple different sources that I saw printed, talked about this, that, you know, party members were just like verbally berated by Healey, screamed at, in some cases then physically assaulted. And then, you know, there is this subterranean thing going on about sexual assault, where a lot of the party members initially, when it's revealed, they close ranks. And they try to actually excuse this and make it just go away. And there have been a lot of Trotskyist parties that have had this problem, right? The SWP in the US, the SWP in Britain, the International Socialist Organization. I don't think there's a direct, like, reciprocal relationship between Trotskyism and sexual abuse, but I don't think it's a coincidence that many different Trotskyist parties have had issues with this kind of behavior from their leaders.
As a fellow historian of Trotskyism, Andy, what's your take on it?
Well, the title of the book is "The Party Is Always Right," and that is a quote from Trotsky, right? I mean, that's the intro of the book. You go through a little bit about how that sort of attitude comes from Trotskyism, and you, if I'm remembering correctly, you make it out that Lenin had a little bit of a, for a time at least, a bit more of a democratic aspect towards the conception of democratic centralism. And even though Trotsky had warned about the dangers of the vanguard party fulfilling the role of leadership of the proletariat, he never really gave up this conception of a singular party core leading international proletarian revolution. And this was the conception of the Fourth International. So even when the Fourth International is forming, you have Trotsky sticking to himself as the figure who has to lead the Fourth International, and his ideas are right, and anyone who disagrees gets expelled or distanced in some way. So I do think that sets the stage for, although it's Trotsky's conception wasn't that Trotskyism would be like hundreds of different tiny sects warring with one another with like singular intellectual figureheads.
That'd be a fucked up thing to try to create, to go out of your way to create.
Yeah, it wasn't his intention, but it was going on even while he was alive around him. Like when the Fourth International formed, it was very small for reasons both of Stalinist and fascist repression, but also because he had expelled a lot of people who could have been important in the left opposition. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't think you can blame the sexual assault on anything that Trotsky did or said. But when you set up a group to have that kind of central leadership, where they're always right, then what they need and their vision becomes essential to the functioning of the party. So it's, it sets it up basically. And that's not just true of Trotskyism. That's true of a lot of Leninist sects, a lot of new communist movement sects, and new religious sects that all kind of prop up at the same time in the 70s. But you talk a lot about Tim Wohlforth throughout the book. And, you know, I also thought his writing on the subject was really helpful when I was writing about Posadas. And he says in his book, On the Edge, what's the name of the book again?
Secular Political Cults.
Yeah. He basically says that the DSA is a good model or the best model to combat abuse in militant revolutionary formations because it has this prohibition of democratic centralism. So I guess I'd ask if in your research, did you find other Trot or Leninist groups that did it better with a democratic centralist model? Or do you think groups like the DSA have the right idea about adjusting the way organizations work to prevent this kind of abuse?
So, you know, there's a whole literature on Lenin that is often like quite apologetic about, like, oh no, Lenin really meant to be democratic, and what happened later wasn't his fault. And it is very kind of exculpatory about, like, nothing Lenin did was wrong. That was all Stalin. I do think like a democratic centralist party makes total sense in late imperial Russia. And Lenin himself says in What Is to Be Done, the conditions that face us as a socialist movement in Russia are different from any other country in the world. And really, he means like any other country in Europe. So it makes total sense if you're in an authoritarian society that you should be kind of cell-like and cut yourself off from the world a little bit, because the world is quite dangerous.
Yeah, they were outlaws, right? Like it was illegal to publish their newspaper, and they were able to publish, you know, tens of thousands of copies.
And all organizations on the left were rife with police provocateurs and spies and
So the average branch of the Russian Social Democratic Party lasted about 6 months before it gets exposed. So that makes total sense. There are things in, say, texts like State and Revolution where Lenin is clearly quite democratic, or he is thinking very democratically. I think what is the problem is that stuff starts to disappear once the revolution happens, and the party kind of ossifies into something much more rigid. I think as a historian, I'm very good at spotting what went wrong in the past, and I would make no claims about my ability to say what should be different in the future. So I don't really know what the alternative is. I'm sort of nominally a member of DSA, but I wouldn't really claim to be particularly active in it. I do like open organizations rather than closed organizations. I like being a part of an organization where I can criticize leadership. I don't want to ever be in an organization where you can't do that. The one thing I think Leninism does right is discipline. And like, discipline's not a bad thing. And the ability of those kinds of parties to kind of close ranks to a certain degree and to say, well, we're not going to have any open criticisms. We will have our criticisms internally.
Right.
That's good. That's kind of good.
Yeah.
You don't want to air your dirty laundry in public.
Don't run your mouth on social media about every little feud within the party.
So certainly some of that is good. You know, at the most basic level in my own politics, I'm always kind of animated by the idea that every choice you make has positive and negative consequences. It has the positive consequences that you want, but it will have negative consequences too. So you may have really positive reasons why you want to structure your party in a cell-like vanguardist structure, But that comes with the cost of you might end up being kind of dictatorial. And certainly if you get into power, that dictatorialness will not disappear. Being a really open party is a good positive choice to make, but it comes with the possibility that like you just become this kind of incoherent thing where everyone's saying crazy stuff and you've no real ability to sort of to shut people up to a certain degree or to get people on message. That can be the kind of negative consequence of a really open party. I don't know what this would look like, and I'm not going to try and theorize that or anything like that, but somehow a party that is both really open but really disciplined. I don't know how you would do that, but that's what I'd like to see. That would be the solution. I think there are Trotskyist parties that do really good things, even if they're kind of negative in some ways. The WRP did do some good stuff, right? Their pro-Palestinian solidarity, I think, was really good. There is really brilliant stuff that the SWP did in the 70s and 80s in Britain to do with anti-racism and anti-Nazi activism. Thatcher is eventually brought down in Britain by the militant tendency and poll tax for protests.
These are the Trotskyists within the Labour Party.
Yeah, and that's a Trotskyist group that had been essentially expelled from the Labour Party. Those groups all had nasty sides to them, and two of them have had very serious sexual scandals, but they did some good stuff. So even those like parties that I have like a lot of concerns about are capable of doing good things.
My views on these things, I think, are clear to the listeners of this show. And so I don't want to like upbraid you, Aiden, with my particular views on things. But I think a lot of this is overdetermined by the sort of cargo cult nature of like left intellectuals and the historic alienation between like what's supposed to be the merger of like an intelligentsia, socialist intelligentsia on the one hand, and a mass working base with its own like civil, social or labor institutions on the other hand. I think barring that, the tendencies that we see here towards abuse, towards closed-mindedness, towards sectarianism are really as much about tendencies of like middle-class intellectuals within capitalist society as they are anything to do with Trotskyism. But then like, okay, how would we create that mass working class base? That's a whole other question, right? But I feel like a lot of this is overdetermined by like the particular role that intellectuals play in this particular class society that we have.
Yeah. And within these groups, I think, I mean, there are intellectuals and they're like self-appointed intellectuals within the group. The degree to which then that becomes part of where you can't criticize those people and you're not allowed. And they set up these structures to kind of insulate themselves from any kind of criticism. That's not a good thing.
Yeah. I fully agree on that.
So I've got some more contemporary questions to ask you about the SCP, who publishes the World Socialist website, which I think everyone on the left is at least familiar with, and some of their weird ideas. And then also this
scandal. Andy's going to bring up the Big Bang.
No, that's IMT, different group.
Oh, shit. Oh, God, Andy, you're so much better at this.
No, SCP is the Woody Allen defenders.
Thank you. Okay.
And then I want to get into the story about Trotsky's death mask, and then also talk a little bit maybe about something somewhat unrelated. I saw that you're the editor of a journal called Irish Questions and Jewish Questions. So I want to ask you some Irish and Jewish questions as well. Maybe
great.
Being a little
very topical and very important.
So especially as the
Irish peacekeeping force under the UN flag faces down the IDF, some of them being fired upon in Lebanon right now.
Some Zionists are fantasizing about nuking Ireland. But we'll. We will talk about that spicy stuff after the paywall. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hear it, go to patreon.com/theantifada and sign up, and you can listen to the full episode there. I did some wrong, but I'm always right. So I know how to shoot, and I know how to fight. If I tell you once, I'll tell you twice. I'm real discreet.